At this point, we're going to go into the question and answer session. So again, as I mentioned to you before, this is an opportunity to ask questions and also to share your views as what you think as to what's going on in Nepal. So gather your thoughts. A request from Lee. It would be great if people, I know it's a huge auditorium, but it would be great if people could just move up forward.
And also identify themselves.
Okay. You would come down, come forward, and you'll be closer to the microphone, so that way your question or your comment could be heard. Is that on?
Okay. In your presentation, you said that several governments have taken sides for the Royal Nepali government, and I think I heard you say that even the Chinese government has taken side for the Royal Nepalese government. Are there any governments or any organization that actually has taken side for, you know, the people insurrection?
Just briefly, a lot of people actually, I was just on a tour in Europe where I spoke in, you know, throughout Europe and gave the same slide presentation, and a really common question that came up was like, well, if they're Maoists, does China support them? You know, because Maoists from China. And I think a lot of what people don't really understand is that everything that Mao stood for was reversed after his death, and that China is now a completely capitalist country. And in fact, one of the things that has happened is that when the King Gyanendra went to China to ask them for support to crush the Maoists, the Chinese government made an official statement denouncing the Maoists and saying they had nothing to do. I mean, they said, we have nothing to do with them, we don't support them, and we support the government in crushing this. So, you know, China has definitely taken a stand on this. In terms of other governments, there's not been a single government that has come out in support of the Maoists, and many, many governments, especially throughout Europe, who have taken, at least made political statements in support of the Nepalese government. One of the things that is interesting, though, is that I talked a little bit in my presentation about how the CPN Maoists really see their revolution as part of the world revolution. And one of the concrete applications of this view is that they actually have put forward and are putting into practice their strategic view, not just of Nepal, for seizing power in Nepal, but also the role that they feel that they can play throughout the whole region. So, for instance, they have played a major role in developing organizational unity among Maoist forces throughout the South Asian region, in India and Bangladesh and other countries in that area. And this includes a unity with Maoist forces in India that are actually waging armed insurgencies. So this is something that's like completely freaked out not only India but the United States, because they recognize that that the impact of this struggle already, and especially if it actually seizes power, would have tremendous ramifications throughout the whole subcontinent. And I mean, even the border between India and Nepal could be redrawn. So there is, you know, while there isn't any, you know, governments that are supporting the People's War in Nepal, there are other Maoist organizations. And again, the Communist Party of Nepal, Maoist, is a participant in the Revolutionary Internationalist movement. So there is like concrete expressions and forms of international solidarity and unity and support for the People's War.
My name is Arvind. I come from Baglung district in Nepal. My comment about your presentation is that your presentation is like advocating violence. And my main point is that, like, you don't have, you can be progressive and you don't necessarily have to be violent. You can be progressive and non-violent. And I think if you look at the history, I'm not a history major or anything like that, but for my cursory look at history, the revolutions that have been successful over the past, in the past 20th century at the lowest cost in terms of human lives are the ones that have been done peacefully. Whether it's in India, whether it's a civil rights movement in the US, whether it's in South Africa, people can say, okay, the South African ANC had an armed wing, but its armed wing did not defeat the white regime. It was a peaceful movement that defeated the white regime. So, like, I don't know why, like, they have to be mutually exclusive. The other point is that, and you may address to that question, is that what is happening since the inception of, like, the Maoist insurgency in 1996 is that the government of Nepal has moved more and more to the right. So basically what you have is a far-left Maoist movement and far-right, the government fighting each other. And who are caught in between are the people in rural villages. And I do come from a rural village, so I do know the experience. I mean, I've been in this country for like 10 years, so... but I do know, like, through contacts, what's happening there. What is happening is that you point out the fact that, like, government forces go to rural villages and interrogate people, arrest people. That's true. But what happens is what's happening is that the government does not have enough resources to occupy the whole country. The government forces leave the village. What happens? The Maoists come in to talk to the guys who give hospitality. I mean, to the government forces. Because what happens is that government troops come to a village. They tell people, okay, you have to give us food, you have to give us hospitality. I mean, what do people have? They have no choice. They have to give the government the things they demand. But the government doesn't stay there for like more than a few days. Government lives, what happens? The Maoists are in hiding in the forest. They come down, they attack the villagers because they tell them that you're siding with the government. In fact, they're not siding with the government. They're just like innocent civilians. So what's happening now is like the civilian, innocent, like Maoist people like claim that they are like for the innocent civilians. But if you look at the reality, that is not the case. What's happening is that like these two like right-wing and left-wing forces like fighting has created a situation where innocent civilians are caught in the middle. One typical example, in the rural village, in my village, there is a high school, and the headmaster of the high school is a guy with a master's degree. He's very competent also, was competent. And the problem is that like in Nepal, it's very hard to find people with any kind of degree going back to villages and teach in the rural areas. So what's happening since the revolution is that this guy got get caught between the Maoist and the government forces. So he's forced to leave the village. He's moved his whole family to the city and living as a refugee. So the reality is like, I mean, Maoist movement will have much more credibility if it's much more peaceful. I think like, you know, it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy. But I think like in terms of sustainability, in terms of like effectiveness in the long run, I think that is the approach it should be taking. Maoist like movement does have a lot of legitimate like arguments. And I think a lot of people support it. I think it's the violence that has thrown a lot of people off. It's the people like me who genuinely think that like we are progressive. There are a lot of changes that are required in Nepal. But the kind of wanton killing that's going on, both by Maoist and both by the government, that's becoming self-defeating. And the last point being that you talk about India being totally siding with the government. That is not true. India is like siding with both Maoist and the government because one of the interests of India is they want to destabilize the Nepalese government. If you look at all the Maoist leaders, they are all in New Delhi. The Indian government knows exactly where they are. If Indian government doesn't know it, at least the British government should know it. You know why? Babram Bhattacharya's wife lives in England. If the MI6 really wants to tap their phone and tap their calls, they will know exactly where Babram Bhattacharya is. So the fact that all these governors, at least the Indian government is totally siding with the government is untrue. Indian government is a hegemonic power. There's no doubt about it. What it wants is instability in Nepal so that it can take as much resource from Nepal as it can. If Nepal is like unified, strong, whether it's like one party to Maoism or like multi-party system now. If it's unified, India will have very little leverage in Nepal. The only way India will have leverage in Nepal is through destabilization.
Okay. All right. Just a request to the people that are going to come up with comments or questions, if you could make it brief, because we want to make sure that everyone has an opportunity to do so. Okay.
I also try to keep my comments brief. Also, I want to invite people. I don't want to just be question-answer. So if other people, I know there's actually some people who have some knowledge about, you know, Nepal too, that they can also speak to some of the issues that are being raised. I just want to speak to, I can't speak to everything that you raised, but I want to speak to two things that you raised. One is the question of violence, and the second point of the people being quote-unquote caught in the middle. In terms of the question of violence, I think one of the things that people have to understand is that this is actually a civil war that's going on, you know. And in terms of, like, one of the things that I think, you know, you talk about history, I think one of the things that history has shown is that unless the people actually struggle and take up arms against reactionary governments, that they can't get rid of them. That in other words, one of the things that's real interesting about the situation of the communist movement in Nepal is that for many, many decades there's been fierce struggle within the communist movement there over whether or not things could change through the parliamentary process. And in 1991, when they had their first elections and the monarchy was basically had to institute a new parliamentary form, so there's a lot of hope, you know, that things would change, you know, that they would then have, you know, kind of democracy, there would be elections, and that the people would finally be able to solve some of these problems. And so for many years, you know, people did, you know, have some hope, some renewed hope that this would be the case. And meanwhile, within the communist movement, because it's a very large and diverse and, you know, the whole spectrum of different lines in the communist movement in Nepal, is that there was huge struggle over whether or not to participate in that parliamentary process. And many different parties did participate in that. And one of the things that I think people learn was that, you know, the grip of the monarchy on the economic and political control of the country, the grip of the reactionary forces, and even the different political parties in control of the ruling class in Nepal and their relationship with India, that none of that could really be changed. You know, that just working within the parliament, working with, you know, carrying out elections, that none of that was fundamentally going to change, especially the question of foreign domination. And one of the things that the Maoists have, you know, strongly put forward is that their revolution is not aimed, and these negotiations are not aimed at being in a position to participate in the present setup. Because their whole vision of what it's going to take to actually solve the problems in Nepal is completely, you know, cannot be done with the present setup. And that in order to actually do the land reform and actually to be able to get rid of the caste system, to get rid of the kind of women's oppression, the semi-feudal relations in the countryside, to actually put power in the hands of the people means actually overthrowing the whole present setup and the ruling class. And the only way that this can be done is through armed struggle, through civil war. You know, it's not that they, you know, and the other thing I think about violence is that, look, tremendous amount of violence was going on before the launching of the People's War. I mean, people were being killed every day, you know. I mean, one of the things that I learned was when I went there and was one of the major campaigns that was carried out by the government was carried out in the 6 months before the armed struggle was initiated. So even before the Maoists launched the armed struggle, there was like huge, you know, repression and murder and, you know, corruption in the countryside. You know, and so the question of the masses of poor peasants having the right to take up arms to overthrow their oppressors is like a really, you know, as a fundamental question for not only people in Nepal, but for people around the world. And then just on the level of kind of like what's actually happening, I mean, if you look at even just the figures, you know, if you want to talk about violence, I mean, you know, that even by the government's own accounts, that of the 7,000 people that have been killed since the start of this war, that, you know, 80-90% of those people have been people killed by government forces and, you know, of so-called suspected Maoists. you know. And the question of the people caught in the middle, again, I think it comes back to like the question of civil war, that anytime you have this kind of upheaval and sharp, you know, revolution, counter-revolution, you know, intensifying situation, that there's going to be different sections of the population that react to that differently. In other words, you are going to have people that feel that they are caught in the middle, or are literally caught in the middle because they don't support the Maoists and they don't support the government. You know, even at the point that I was there, when the Maoists would carry out raids in villages, that immediately a lot of the reactionaries, you know, the landlords, the corrupt politicians, they would flee. They weren't really caught in the middle. They just wanted to get out of there, you know. And then there were other people that, you know, were staunchly supportive of the Maoists. I mean, they were the most oppressed. They were the people that the youth who were joining the People's Army. And then there were also people who may have been, you know, owned a little bit more land, or maybe had positions in the government. Or were benefiting from some of the, you know, traditional oppressive relations in the countryside, and some of those people either, you know, may have stayed in those areas and may have fled, you know. And so, but I think the thing is, so you have a very, you know, intense situation in which the government is carrying out intense, you know, campaigns, going into the villages and you know, rounding up people and accusing all kinds of people of being sympathizers. And I don't think it's actually accurate to say that, like, what happens is the government goes in and they kind of fuck over the people, and then the Maoists come in after they leave and they also do the same thing. I mean, by all accounts, even the enemies of the Maoists have to admit that they have tremendous support in the countryside, and that their army is growing, and that cannot be happening if everyone is, you know, it's not a situation that people can just be coerced into that. I mean, you can't have, you know, thousands of people or literally millions of people living in these areas without real support. And I think that's the overall character, you know, thing that's happening in Nepal. So I think that there, you know, that this question of, or this, you know, and this is put out in the international press a lot, that, you know, that you have a situation of a lot of innocent people being caught in the middle. I think that's not, doesn't really characterize accurately what's actually happening there.
I read a report by Amnesty International a few months ago. I'm trying to speak into my, I think the mic doesn't work.
Mic is not working.
Recently, a few months ago, a report by Amnesty International, which described the civil rights abuses both of the Nepalese government and of the Maoists, and it more or less concluded that they were equal. The question to you is, can you imagine a situation in which civil rights abuses are only for the purpose of your civil war, after which it's all going to be no civil rights abuses? You don't expect any sort of carry-on into perhaps a cultural revolution situation?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what kind of civil rights abuses you're referring to. I mean, one thing that I think is...
murder and all of the civil rights abuses you can imagine Amnesty International investigates. Same sort of things that the government is involved in.
Well, first of all, I think if you look at the Amnesty International report, it's actually not equal, even in terms of quantitative. I mean, Amnesty International has pages and pages of documentation of human rights violations being carried out by the government. And even by their own accounts, you know, it's like, you know, they have, you know, it's like one-tenth, or, you know, like they'll talk about thousands of people being killed in the countryside by the government, and like 150 or 200 cases that they document, which they say are human rights violations by the Maoists. So it isn't really true to say that they equally, you know, that there's an equal situation on, even by the counts of groups like Amnesty International. I think the other thing that people have to really understand is that, again, when I talked about the question of misinformation and disinformation, is that I think it's really, really hard for people to get accurate information in a situation where the government is, like, you know, totally censoring the news and not even allowing reporters into those areas, including people from Amnesty International, and that there's tremendous amounts of you know, stories that are coming out that are later even proven, are admitted by Western, you know, mainstream journalists to be not true, you know, even in the terms of these accounts of these battles that are going on. I've seen articles that will come out one week and, you know, a week later you'll see an article that just completely, you know, reports something different. I think the other thing is that, I'll just give one example, is like, for a while there was a lot of stories that were coming out about the Maoists that were, you know, kidnapping and targeting teachers, you know, and, you know, this was like, there's like all kinds of articles in the news about this, and one of the things is that assassinating members of other political parties. And so if you just read that, you would think like, well, that doesn't, you know, that seems like really like a human rights violation. They're just targeting teachers and then just killing people of other political parties. But when you really look into the situation, I think that the actual situation is that a lot of these people that are being targeted are actually people that are participating in collaborating with the government, with the RNA soldiers, to leading to situations in which, you know, hundreds if not thousands of people are being rounded up and killed. So if you have a revolution, how can the people allow that to happen? I mean, if you're waging a revolution how can you allow people who are giving information to the government or that's leading to, you know, people being rounded up and killed and tortured? I mean, the first excerpt that I read from dispatches of the cultural squad that was killed, that cultural squad, the situation was that a member of the UML, a political party, had actually led the police to where they were staying in a safe house, and which had led to the murder of this young cultural squad, you know. And this is the kind of thing that a lot of the people that are being targeted by the revolution are not innocent people. They're people that are actually siding with the government and carrying out, you know, crimes against the people. And the other thing is that, and you know, and this is something that I've heard from many people who have been in Nepal, and these are not all people that are even sympathetic to the revolution, is that a lot of these people they have a policy of warning people three times. You know, that they actually go up to people who are doing bad things, who are, you know, collaborating with the government, who are oppressing the people, and telling them and saying, look, you shouldn't be doing this, you should stop doing this, you know, and we're giving you fair warning. And that they have a policy of actually warning people three times, and if they continue, then they're targeted by the revolution. You know, and again, this is something that has been accounted to me by a number of different kinds of people, including people who have traveled in the countryside that are not necessarily that sympathetic to the Maoists.
Should I come up?
That mic is fine.
This one is not working.
Yes.
Well, I'm from Bihar in India. And we have a number of groups too, known under various names: CP, Communist Party, ML, Marxist Leninist, and MCC. I'm not sure what MCC stands for. Recently, a group, People's War Group, WPG, has been coming up in Bihar, and they also are in Andhra Pradesh. And I think there may be a few more groups. I have exactly the same kind of problem that the gentleman earlier raised. I don't know where he is. I'd like to speak to him later. Where is he? Can he? Okay, thank you. You see, I have to tell you that I'm myself, Dalit, and particularly in Bihar, I don't know how much is the parallelism between what's going on in Nepal and what's happening in Bihar. But in Bihar, basically, it's a caste war. There are castes which hold land. They have land holdings. Bhumihar, they are called, basically. And so they have Ranveer Sena. And they want to exploit the lower castes as laborers, and if they refuse to come and work for a certain wage, they want higher wage, then they basically beat them, shoot them, kill them, whatever. So that has been going on. So the CPIML or some of these organizations have organized and opposed. Now the problem that happens is that as long as it's clandestine and based on armed kind of insurrection, first of all, it's not getting government support, so they have to be really clandestine. And in a way, it's kind of like it cannot be run democratically. You can't have hold open meetings, and you can't have really open exchange of opinions and change of leadership, particularly. So whoever becomes the leader somehow at whatever level, he or oh, it's mostly he, not too many she's are there in these. He may be just one of their brothers, but he becomes kind of dictatorial. So instead of losing your freedom to these exploiting castes, you lose your freedom. And like they even had the saying that if you leave this group, then you'll become 6 inches smaller, means you'll be chopped. You know, I mean, these kind of excesses, maybe it's not too prevalent, but these kind of threats are there. So truly, as far as exploitation with the help of arms is concerned, it does need to be opposed by arms. But personally, I feel that if the arms were more distributed to practically all the oppressed people, without really trying to organize them under some kind of leadership. I mean, like here, Americans at the time of their revolution, people had freedom to bear arms. So similarly, over there also, they should have freedom to bear arms, and people should be able to individually protect themselves without having to organize themselves under somebody, even if it's one's own brother. If he becomes your head of the group, then you are basically under him. So I'm, in a nutshell, I'm kind of confused, and I don't really feel that this kind of armed insurrection, even though it has been pretty old, I mean, like in Bihar, it has been going on for more than 20, 30 years or so, and they haven't truly produced results much. So,
okay. All right. We're going to keep these comments short because actually we have this hall only till 6:30, and it's already 6:05. So if we could make them brief, maybe we could take those two. Come to the mic and.
I'd like to thank you first for this demonstration. I think anybody, whatever their political orientation, would say that it's very hard to get news on Nepal, so this has been very helpful for me. I have really two questions. First is that we have knowledge with the China over its history has gone in a very different direction than it was at its time of its revolution. But if in Nepal, I would think it would be very kind of disorienting or confusing for the people of Nepal to understand how China, birthplace of Maoism, has gone in such a different direction and doesn't support its revolution. I'm curious if that's at all, if that's disillusioning, or if that really hurts the movement at all in some degree. And also, I'm a student journalist. I'm editor of the Stuyvesant High School newspaper. I try to follow the case of Krishna Sen, and again, it's been really hard to find news of the latest developments. I know there were a lot of protests going on after his death. I was wondering if those have continued or papers have been able to publish freely to any extent in the last few months, or if it's, you know, the profession has been very successful. So thank you.
Just let me try to respond to that quickly. In terms of the question around China, I mean, one thing I found was really interesting, because I'm kind of a from the generation that was really inspired by the the socialist revolution in China. And when I was in Nepal, actually a lot of the leadership, including Prachanda, who I interviewed when I was there, is of that generation, And so they were actually part of the intense struggle that went on internationally to sum up what happened after Mao died, and that part of the, as I mentioned, a participant in the Revolutionary Internationalist Movement, which has, analyzed the what happened after Mao died in terms of the intent, the what that says about the struggle under socialism, that the continuing class struggle under socialism, and the need for continuous culture revolutions and leadership to continually revolutionize society. And one of the things I found was really interesting is that that there is a lot of actual broad mass education that goes on in the base areas, and right now they're actually rewriting the textbooks. They have a whole thing called Janabadi education, which is like basically people's education, to educate people with their true history and also world history and the history of the questions confronting the communist movement internationally, including how to sum up what happened in China and what that means for future revolutions and socialist societies. On the question of the journalists, I mean, one thing is that there's continued to be, censorship. I mean, even though the state of emergency has been rescinded, that a lot of the practices under the state of emergency have continued, including censorship of the press. I know that some of the editors and writers, like from Janadesh, were in the last couple months released from jail, and some of them came out and talked about how they were tortured in jail. But some of them are still either disappeared, people don't know. And I think one of the demands, actually, of these negotiations is that some of those people be either accounted for or released. But I think that's still a really important struggle to be waging to demand the freedom of the press in Nepal, because it's something that, I mean, it is one of the reasons why it's both hard to get information, and the information you get is a lot of times totally unreliable.
Thank you, Lee, for coming so far. I just wanted to ask you, can you talk a little bit about the contradiction of having leaders in a Maoist movement who are all upper caste Brahmins, and having most of the people who are following there from obviously lower caste and minority tribes? Because I talked to a man who was a former Maoist, and he had left because he felt disillusioned. He said because he thought that there was a kind of a hierarchy of caste still in the leadership, and that the leaders were still eating good rice while they were giving the, the rank and file bad rice. That was one of the examples he used. Can you talk a little bit about how this might work out in terms of having all the leadership being upper caste?
Just briefly, I think one of the things, just kind of an overall backdrop to this, is one of the things that is actually happening in terms of the caste question is that, and it's explicitly spelled out in their political program for both what's implemented in the base areas now, but also for future society, is the breaking down of the caste system, and this is something that is a goal of the revolution, and that the program of the Maoists there see that there cannot actually be liberation of all the Nepalese people without breaking down the caste system and giving equality to the many, many oppressed national minorities there. And actually, one of the reasons why I think that the revolution is so strong in the Ropa Rukam and Western districts is that those areas are very much made up of lower caste and, like, Magar people, oppressed national minorities who really have been drawn forward into the revolution because of their program of equality of oppressed nationalities and lower caste. I mean, one just kind of anecdotal thing, a lot of the people that I met, one of the things that would be a common occurrence is that young couples would come up and introduce themselves. And the way that they would introduce themselves is they would first say very proudly that we are a love marriage, meaning that this was a marriage that was not arranged, that this was a revolution, a marriage of their own choosing. And this was a very radical thing in Nepal. And the second thing that a number of people would tell me is that they would point to each other and smile and say, this is an inter-caste marriage. So that among the rank and file, the question of breaking down the caste is a very important, and you know, there's a lot of struggle over doing that. As far as the leadership question, I mean, one of the things, I mean, I can't really speak to the eating rice question, but I can speak to the question of the breaking down of the transformation of the leadership, and not just in terms of the caste question, but this also relates to the question of old and young, of women and men, and upper and lower castes, and also different national minorities. Because at the time that the armed struggle was initiated, it is true that the leadership of the party, and not just the leadership, but the main composition of the party was more, you know, people with backgrounds of upper castes, and also intellectuals and students. But this was something that has been radically transformed by the actual process of developing the People's War. I mean, and the also, it's not only that the main composition of the army and the party is now poor peasants and lower caste people and oppressed minorities, but that the party actually is working at developing the leadership of those sections of society. And just quickly, I know that, I mean, this is a question I had when I went there and I interviewed people. And one of the things I know that some of the leading party members told me was that there was specifically efforts to bring both younger people into the Central Committee and to regional levels of leadership, as well as women and also lower castes and oppressed minorities. So, you know, there's both kind of the you know, on the lower levels, like the, you know, the into the army and into the mass organizations of just, you know, a lot of poor peasants and lower caste people, but also efforts by the leadership to specifically develop those people are in leadership positions. And, you know, and it's a process that goes on, you know, because but it is an aim and goal of the leadership and of the revolution there.
I mean, this is, I guess, a question I more wanted to pose, you know, around this whole question people are bringing up of, oh, you know, these tactics that are being used by the rebels. I mean, if we look at history, you know, in the Warsaw Ghetto, there was a certain way people dealt with collaborators, you know, and enemy agents. And it was the same way that people dealt with this in South Africa in the fight against apartheid, you know, in Palestine and Northern Ireland and everywhere where people rise up and rebel. And I would just sort of ask people, what other way would you deal with someone who, I mean, as Lee pointed out, it's not just a question of disagreeing with someone. I mean, somebody goes and leads a government agent to a house and these seven young people got killed. I mean, do you just sort of tell them, oh, all right, that's cool, keep on doing it? I guess I'd just like to pose a question. How do people propose dealing with this kind of situation if not in the way it's been dealt with by oppressed people historically?
One of the things, like in inviting people here, is we said to people that come, you can get a glimpse of the future. And I just wanted to ask what it was like, what it felt like when you actually crossed into the base areas and actually saw people living a whole different way. If you could talk about what that felt like.
Over the time.
Well, again, just briefly, I mean, one of the things is that it's really, maybe I'll say it this way, because it's briefly, is that when you go to Nepal, first of all, it's in one level, it's really depressing because you see how poor and oppressed people are. I mean, it's like, let me put it this way, if you go to Nepal and then you go to India, India looks really developed in relationship to Nepal. And India is really, really poor and oppressed, you know. I mean, Nepal is even, you know, whatever UN statistic, is one of the poorest countries in the world. So on the one hand, you see like this intense, deep poverty and caste oppression and oppression of women. And when you go into the base areas, you see that in the faces of the people. You know, you see kind of the hard lives they've lived. You see, I mean, you know, you meet a woman who is 50 years old and she's really, I mean, life expectancy is 55. And in the United States, she looks like someone who is maybe 80 because of the kind of living conditions, you know. Or you see children, you know, who basically are malnourished. But the thing that was really inspiring is that when you went from the areas that were not, you know, in the areas of the guerrilla areas and base areas, you know, you saw that kind of poverty. You went into the base areas and the liberated areas, and it was that same kind of poverty, but the people had hope. You know, they had a different look in there. I mean, I think people can see it in the photos, or I hope they can see it in the photos, that those are people that, on the one hand, are desperately poor and have lived hard lives, but you can see in their faces that the process of revolution, of the hope of the hopeless, of actually being able to, like, do something about your situation, and to not only fight against your enemy, but to fight for something. Because I think one of the things that's so inspiring about the base areas, the liberated base areas, is that look, the revolutionaries are not saying, like, all right, you know, you have your oppressors, let's wage a fight, get rid of them, and then we'll take care of everything, you know. One of the reasons why I think this revolution has grown and has so much popularity is that in the base areas, people are actually seeing the seeds of the future. They're actually seeing the transformations that are taking place. They're seeing the kind of feudal traditions that are being broken down. Women are seeing the outlines of liberation. The caste system is being broken down. All these things are real. They're not offering people just pie in the sky and saying that fight with us and after we seize power, we'll solve all these problems. The outlines of that are actually being implemented in real life. And it means something for the people, you know, for a peasant to be able to actually have land, to actually begin to collectively farm land, for the women to actually, you know, for the first time in their lives, being given the right to have a divorce, or to not be, you know, oppressed by an arranged marriage, or to have the right to divorce a husband who beats them. I mean, all these kind of things that are not possible in the traditional old society are now being fought for and defended in the liberated areas. So I think this is, you know, like, the thing that's most inspiring about this revolution. It's not just that they're fighting against something, but they're fighting for something, and that they're actually beginning to implement and bring into being the outlines and vision that they stand for. And again, I think you can, I mean, I never get tired of seeing their faces, you know, because I think it's, a lot of it is there.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to end the question and answer session here, but it was really important that people came. We do have to leave this area by 6:30. We have to have it cleared, actually. So I'm going to have to ask that. But before we do leave, I just wanted to let people know that this event has been videotaped. If you know of people who think should have been here tonight but couldn't for whatever reason, we are going to have it available for sale in the very near future. We could also do screenings of the video as well. And if you want, you can even put that down on the index card that you're interested in the video.